Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter. This week's show is a bit of a bumper edition. We're still talking about Black Lives Matter. I think we'll always be talking about it. But we have some really amazing guests on helping us learn and grow this week. First up is Leila Saad, author of White Supremacy and Me. She shares what her teaching about anti-racism can help us with, and just why it's so important that we all take the time to really understand our motivations. She's incredibly inspiring, and my interview with her really allowed me to understand the importance of the work she does, but also just the toll it takes on everyone to do this, but particularly on Black women, and why it's so important for me as a white person and for any other white people listening to really engage with it. Plus, Shireen Daniels, director of HR Rewired, talks to us about how employers can support their Black employees during this time. And Candice Brathwaite, author and Instagram star, talks about her new book, I Am Not Your Baby Mother, and what it's like to be a Black British mother in the UK. And we meet Florence Given, author of Women Don't Owe You Pretty, talking all about the young feminism and how she is challenging today's beauty standards.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
First up tonight, I talked to Leila Saad about her new book, Me and White Supremacy.
I want to ask you, first of all, for anyone who hasn't read the book, Me and White Supremacy, why white supremacy? Why did you go with that wording?
Yeah, so I started doing this work as a way to help people who didn't necessarily see themselves as racist or didn't necessarily identify themselves as maybe having white privilege or having racist thoughts. That's who I started this work for. And I felt that it was really, really important for us to name this system that we are all conditioned into, and this paradigm and this consciousness that affects everyone. And so in naming it Me and White Supremacy, as opposed to naming it, you know, Me and Implicit Bias or mm-hmm. Me and White Privilege, I really wanted people to understand this is so much bigger than what you realize. And it's not just those other people who you believe are the real racists, but all of us who have been conditioned into this system.
One of the things that I found really interesting about it was exactly that, when you say we think of white supremacy as something that exists over there. It's something that some bad people do, but we're not like them, so we're okay. And I say we as in other kind of white people who go, I'm like everyone, therefore I'm definitely not a racist. And in fact, what you're saying in your book, and what comes across really clearly when you work your way through it, is that if you are a white person living in our white-dominated society, we have all benefited from white supremacy, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And actually, globally, around the world, white people have privilege. They're, even if you're not in a white society, there really isn't any place on this planet where being white is not seen as being of higher value. But going back to your point about people believing that it's not us, it's them, that really comes from this fundamental misunderstanding that racism is about consciously chosen, you know, thoughts and beliefs of believing other races are superior and intentionally wanting to see other people of other races suffer or be oppressed or be marginalized. And that simply isn't true. It really is about how the entire world is set up, which is this belief that white people are superior to people of other races. And then because of that, that they deserve to dominate over people of other races and that they're forgiven privileges and are able to move around in their lives and in the world in ways that black and brown people are not able to do so in the same way. It's similar to, I think people can understand it when we think about male privilege, that there's a way that men are able to move around in the world and that there is no place on this planet where men are not treated as if they are better and of higher value than women. It's the same with having white privilege.
What would you say to people who say, and I know a lot of people, and I am asking largely for my own benefit, so I know what to say to them. What would you say to people who say, well, I know that I'm a good person, and I know that I would never judge anybody by the colour of their skin, and I'm just interested in the people. Therefore, I don't really need to think about whether or not white supremacy applies to me, because I know I'm a good person and I'm okay.
Yeah. So that part about being the good person is what often stops people from looking at their own unconscious racist thoughts and beliefs. Because if your understanding of racism is that racists are bad people, then if you believe you're a good person, you're not going to want to associate with anything to do with racism and therefore wouldn't read anything that's about anti-racism because you already fundamentally believe I'm a good person, therefore I'm not a racist. But we have to separate your sense of goodness from the fact that whether you have consciously chosen it or not, from the moment that you were born into this world, society has been reinforcing to you that white people are superior to people of other colors. So if you think about a child growing up, and I know for myself growing up in the 80s, you know, in Wales and then later in the 90s in England, you know, what was reinforced to me through television, through advertising, through the media was that the people who are seen as represented as the norm are white. And if there is a black person or a brown person on the cover of a magazine, for example, or as the lead in a TV show, that's an odd thing, that's not normal, right? And so that reinforcement has nothing to do with that you're consciously choosing to be mean or not a good person. It's what's being reinforced to you all the time. So then if that's what's being reinforced and it's what's normal, then any racist thoughts that you have are also coded as normal, right? Mm-hmm. And especially if you believe racism looks like racial slurs, it looks like attacking people of color, like if those are, you know, that's what racism is, then you don't get to explore what about when you tone police a black or brown person and you tell them that the way that they're expressing themselves isn't the right way for them to express themselves? What about when for example, when you culturally appropriate from a black or brown culture and you believe it's cultural sharing, but you're missing the context of the fact that between your culture and their culture, that there's been a history of colonization, there's been a history of harm, right? Racial harm, that context is missing. And so you can't understand why somebody's saying to you, that's cultural appropriation. That thing you're doing is actually cultural appropriation. And so when that mirror is held up to you, that do you understand that XYZ behavior that you're doing, which you don't feel is racist, is actually racist? Yeah. If you're holding on very, very strongly to, but I'm a good person, then you can't hear the feedback and you won't examine yourself. And so it's really important to separate, understand your goodness is not what's being questioned here. Your goodness this is not about feeling ashamed of yourself. It's not about feeling ashamed of the color of your skin. It's about opening you up to begin to interrogate what have I been conditioned into that I hadn't even realized.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting in the book is that you recommend a list of resources. A list of questions to ask yourself about, you know, how do you see yourself in the world? And do you realize that the way you see the world actually is sort of ingrained racism? And one of those things is the assumption that anytime you ask to speak to the manager, the chances are the manager's probably going to look like you.
Right. And I was going to add, and if they don't look like you, recognize, is there a moment of surprise that they don't look like you, that they're in a position of leadership? What is the first thought, the automatic thought, not the one that you correct it with because you recognize that's a racist thought to have, but the immediate first thought that comes up. It's about that. It's about pulling that out and really shining a light on that.
The interesting thing about your book is it's not really a book that you read. It's a book that you do. So you ask people, actually, there are exercises at the end of each chapter. You ask people to keep a journal as they go through it. You say, very interesting at the beginning, that there are going to be times when actually maybe you want to put the book down, or it gets a bit too much, or you're going to find it hard going, but please keep going. What made you decide to write the book?
So I had been talking about white supremacy for about a year before doing what was the inception of this work, which was actually an Instagram challenge called Me and White Supremacy, using the hashtag Me and White Supremacy. And I'd noticed that, if I tell white people this is racist, or this is an action that is racist, there's a lot of defensiveness there. Whereas the difference between let me explain things to you and then pose some questions for you and then get you to explore how this shows up for you, that created a different kind of opportunity for white people and people with white privilege to really explore how racism shows up for them. And it allowed them to take responsibility for their own learning while taking the burden off of me. And so I wanted to create a process, and, you know, it was an Instagram challenge and now it's a book. I wanted to create a process where white people and people with white privilege can actually take responsibility for their own learning. I wanted them to have a resource that they can actually do the work with, as opposed to reading and sort of intellectually taking in the information, but just staying there. And when there is that sort of intellectual taking in of the information, oftentimes there's still that exceptionalism that says, oh, that's other white people, but it's not me. And this is very much about your own individual personal exploration of how you have unconscious racist thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors. Because your own self, that's the only place where you have complete control. And, you know, racism and white supremacy operates at many different levels, including institutional and systemic, but it also operates on the personal level, and systems and institutions are created by human beings. And so I wanted to create a place where people could say, this is the place where I can begin to take responsibility for anti-racism, for creating an anti-racist world, by looking at myself and how I am unknowingly contributing to the world that we currently have.
What would you say to people who say that it's all very well to try and change ourselves and to try and change our own behavior, but until institutions actually change, nothing is going to change? That we actually need to change the institutions 100%. Before we change ourselves.
100%. And that's why I say at the end of the book, I talk about this dismantling work has to happen on multiple levels, and different people, depending on where they sit in terms of their privileges of identities, but also, you know, what they do in the world. Do they have power to, you know, are they in positions of leadership? Are they in positions to vote? Each one of those things is important to tackle, the personal, the systemic, and the institutional. But it's my hope that in people doing the personal work, that they begin to connect to this understanding that it's not just about changing laws. It's not just that, right, we just had the toppling of the statue, right, in Bristol. It's not just about toppling the statue if people's consciousness is still racist. The fact that that statue was able to stay up for all these years, despite efforts, real efforts by people to canvass for it to be taken down and for names to be changed of schools, etc., that it had to take this time that we're in right now for people to say enough is enough, means that even if the statue was removed, people's thinking hadn't changed. And so it's the same with laws and policies. yes, we need to change the laws, we need to change the policies, but we also need to change the consciousness as well, because we have to create a culture of anti-racism and not just laws that are anti-racist. If it were just about changing the laws, when slavery was abolished, we would have an anti-racist world immediately. Yeah. But we don't. Yeah.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
Now, before the break, we were talking about the kind of big institutions and how we're starting to see some of the real pushback against our institutions and the way they behave, particularly in the toppling of the statue in Bristol and in the protests going on around the world at the moment. What do you think the legacy of these protests is going to be?
Well, I think no one can deny that we're in a really important time of history right now. I have never seen anything like what we are seeing around the world. It should be, you know, emphasized as well, not just in the United States, but all over the world, where, you know, Black people and people who are showing up in allyship for Black people are saying enough is enough. You know, tell the truth about how Black people are treated differently in this society. We are in 2020. This isn't good enough anymore. And change must come. And so I think it's hard to, you know, predict what will come of this moment. But I will say that it is very important for people not to feel like, okay, this is great, there's protests. Once the protests are over, we can go back to a sense of normalcy because, you know, we made change. No, we haven't made change. We're starting now to create change. And it's on everybody, but especially on people who have white privilege, to really be taking up the responsibility of how can I make sure that these protests were not in vain, that when we showed up, we didn't just show up in the moment because of the energy of the moment, but we kept showing up afterwards, even when the cameras were not there, even when, you know, the quote-unquote excitement of the moment was no longer there. How can we make sure to keep going? Because this work is lifelong work. One of the things that really drives me is this idea of becoming a good ancestor. It's what I put on the, you know, subtitle of my book. I host a podcast called Good Ancestor Podcast. I teach anti-racism classes through Good Ancestor Academy. Like, it's the through line of everything that I do, because it's this constant reminder to me that, you know, my life is not just my own. My life belongs to my children and my children's children and all people who will come after I'm gone. And so I really encourage people to really think long term, and not just even of your lifetime, but lifetimes to come, because we are the products and the beneficiaries right now of the ancestors who came before us, who said, no, you know, slavery is heinous and should be abolished. Women should have rights, right? All of these things have come about. The world that we have now is because of the ancestors who came before us and said enough is enough. And so we need to be those ancestors now in this lifetime.
I'm sorry, I just had to pause there, because what you said really struck me so deeply about that we are the ancestors of the people who came before us, and that those of us, the people who come after us, will look to us and what we did and the way we behave now, the change we made. That feels really powerful. Yeah. You talk about how the work you do is a form of healing. Why do you use that term?
It's healing for me first and foremost. And the thing about not having white privilege is that you are not conditioned to believe that you are the norm and that you are superior, or that you deserve to be centered, or that your life should, you know, have a sense of ease and normalcy that people of color don't have. We are conditioned into the complete opposite. And what we carry with us is our own, you know, the stories of our own upbringing, and as well as, you know, the things that I'm thinking of in particular of an Instagram live I saw the other day of David Oyelowo, and he was talking about every black person has a racial wound. There's stories that we have and things that have happened to us that really reminded us, you know, you are a black person, and this is what that means. And so in doing this work of helping to co-create with people around the world, helping to co-create an anti-racist world, it's the way that I affirm to myself that I matter, that I, as a black Muslim woman, I matter, my children matter, my parents, my husband, my siblings and their children, they matter. And it's also about helping to create a world where everybody, people of all races, get to live in the fullness of their humanity, which is not the world we have today. The world we have today says people who are black and brown, their humanity is worth less than people who are white. But also for people who are white and who have white privilege, they're also not living in the fullness of their humanity, because to oppress and to marginalize and to, to do that, to be supreme over anyone else also takes away from your own humanity.
Absolutely.
And this is what I have found, right? This is what I have found with people who are doing Me and White Supremacy, but also, you know, exploring all other kinds of books and resources and classes on anti-racism. Yes, it's hard. It's really hard to have that mirror held up to you and for you to start questioning things that you thought were normal and realizing actually you've caused a lot of harm in your life. It's so, so hard. But in telling the truth and in unpicking all of those lies and getting to the truth, you actually get to feel more whole. So this is about healing for all of us, for all of humanity. When we say, you know, I know a lot of people hear the hashtag or the, you know, the phrase Black Lives Matter, and they think, well, you know, all lives matter. My life matters too. And it's like, yes, but your life matters already in the society we live in. We all lives will matter when Black lives matter too. And so it's about creating that healing for all of us.
Thank you for listening to Badass Women's Hour. You can hear us every Saturday on Talk Radio from 7 p.m. for a full 3 hours, yes, 3 hours of opinion, debate and general setting the world to rights. Now let's get back to our guest.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
So obviously the Black Lives Matter protests have been going on across the world this week. And What that's meant for a lot of black people here in the UK is they've started getting questions from their friends. They've had friends asking them very well-meaning questions quite often. What can I do to help? What should I be aware of? Have I offended you? How are you? Questions that have a lot of heart behind them. But when you're getting them all the time, can be quite draining. And when you're getting them at work, it's even worse. Here to talk about how we can help businesses and how businesses can help their black employees better, Shireen Daniels, Director of HR Rewired. Hi, Shireen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, what impact are the current riots having on black people's working lives at the moment?
Just as you said in your intro, it's tough for them right now. They're tired. They are dealing with their own kind of thoughts and feelings, right, about what's been going on in the state. But also they are reflecting on their position in society. You know, one of the things that I spoke out a couple of weeks ago is about what I called the corporate wall of silence. So it was businesses not really acknowledging that this was having an impact on black people here in the UK, particularly black employees. And I think as we've seen, you know, even just in the last couple of days, even today, the emotional and quite divisive reaction to Black Lives Matter and the fact that we're just pushing for equality has meant that many employees are now feeling upset. They're feeling exposed, particularly if they're the only black employee in their business. So that's quite common. I'm hearing a lot of that. And the fact that they have to show up every day and, you know, they're on the Zoom calls and, you know, as you said, with a lot of heart and meaning, a lot of businesses are now wanting to talk about it and they're wanting to kind of get people on the same page to understand why it's important. But you have black employees that are struggling to talk about their experiences, are struggling to articulate what years of daily, you know, it's like death by a thousand cuts, right? So all the little things that have happened over the last, you know, most of their working lives, trying to explain that in a half an hour conversation or an hour conversation is really difficult, Yeah. So just as you said, it's well-meaning with a lot of heart. You know, it's almost like, you know, help me understand because I want to do better. But it's also for people to understand it's very difficult to articulate that in a really succinct way that will land with you so you get it and go, right then, you know, I know what I need to do next.
And also I think within that there's an interesting thing around, and I really feel this, which is if you are a white person and what you're seeing is one of your black colleagues constantly having to answer all the questions about, and you know, some of them are well-meaning, but also some of them are just people who want to have a debate or who want, you know, a specific piece of information about this, that and the other. If you're a white woman or man seeing that happen to one of your black colleagues, there's kind of a point where tell me what you think about this, but I feel you should be stepping in and saying, hang on, can I take some of that burden from you, or can we, you know, have a bit of disagreement that we discuss it in this way and in this manner, rather than letting them deal with everything? Is that right, or am I?
Am
I stepping in unnecessarily?
You are not, and I wish more people would do what you've just suggested, to be honest, because I do think there's a little bit of almost like it's a free-for-all, you know, because I think in some people's need to understand, right, because I liken it to a bit like the windows have been blown out, so all of a sudden you can see what life is really like on the other side, and when the penny drops, you're so keen to, you know, fill up the bucket of knowledge, and you want to understand, and you want to do better, and you want to help, but because it's easy for you to go to your black employee or your black colleague or your black friend, you end up, because you're ready, you assume that they're ready. And because you're ready, you assume that they want to make you their priority by definition of answering all of the questions that you have. And I think that's the bit that people have to remember. And that's exactly why what you said is right. Because, you know, if you're non-black or if you're white and you see this, you know, the barrage of questions, because it's happening all the time, Harry, it's happening all the time. You know, I've been getting it. You know, lots of people going, oh my God, I don't understand, Shereen, can you help me? And I'm like, yeah. And, you know, you go through it all and, yeah. And then after a while, you're just like, you know what? Like, I do videos every day now, so I'm just like, watch my video. it's the way to save the daily. And people still come, which is fine, but I do. But I'm fortunate enough to be able to do that. If you've got to show up to work every day, albeit through remote working, it's very difficult. And some employees, Harry, they just feel like they can't say no. Because, and that's the thing that other people have to understand is, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because on one hand, if, you know, cause I've heard this, right, and people have said, well, you black people, you've been wanting to show, you know, and talk about why this is important and how you've been treated and whatever, and we give you the opportunity to do this and you don't want to talk, you know? Yeah. So therefore, and I swear to you, I've heard this.
Yeah,
and, you
that know, doesn't surprise me, and, yeah.
And people will say, you know, well, black people don't make it easy for yourselves because one minute you're wanting this and the next minute you know, we don't know whether we're coming or going. And that's the kind of thing that people don't always understand. They don't understand that there are those conversations happening as well as the one that they have, because like anything, we're just human, right? So we just think, oh, they're only having this conversation with us. They're not cognizant of the fact it's been multiplied out. As soon as you put the phone down, there's somebody else that wants to, and a colleague is messaging you going, did you see the statue that got toppled? What do you think? It's outrageous, isn't it? You know? And sometimes, you know, you just don't want to be drawn into the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it really struck me, you said there, that it's about making the other person a priority, not yourself. One thing that worries me is that a lot of companies are coming out and saying, you know we haven't done very well at this in the past. We're going to be better in the future. We're working with our employees now to find out what they want and how we can support them better. And it feels a little bit like a lot of companies are basically turning their black employees into unpaid diversity and inclusion consultants.
Oh, Harriet, let me tell you, yes. Oh, my goodness. Yes, that is happening left, right and centre. You know, I've had people message me and basically because they just want my advice, right? And they've gone, okay, so the company, you know, right from they're asking their black employees to draft their press statements, their position statements. They want them to come up with, you know, what I call facetiously the 10-point plan to be an anti-racist company. I kid you not. I kid you not. And, you know, when you just think to yourself, guys, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. And, you know, and again, dare I say it, but I have been very honest and I've said it's come from a place of laziness.
Yeah.
Because in 2020, right, Google is free. So you can go and look for free information and find out and read the books and read the resources and go and watch the videos and all the rest of it. And I think if you're making it the responsibility of your black employees exclusively, what you're showing is you only care because you're forced to. But you care only to the point that you want to be seen to be doing something about it, but you don't care enough to be the one to do the work first.
And also, I'm going to say also that there are lots of brilliant black diversity and inclusion consultants out there. So if you really care about this, you can spend some money with them.
Oh my goodness, that's it. And I've had like lots of people, because I've been very vocal about this, and you know, I'm giving a level of real talk that's missing in the corporate world at the moment, because everybody's kind of getting caught up behind PowerPoint slides and, you know, then shiny PDFs. And I've had people wanting to have sound me out for half an hour on what they should do as a business. And do you know what, Harry? I've just said to them, look, I've got videos, you know, on YouTube. Go and have a look. HRBYTV, go and have a look. And then if you need more formal help, that's fine, but I'm charging you because my days of freebies are gone. You know, one of the things that I talk about a lot, particularly for black people, is there's always an expectation that we will do things for free because we're grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, and I bought into that. So I decided when I started speaking out, I was like, no more, I'm not doing this anymore. But there is still that mentality of, you know, just as you said before, because they're ready, they expect everybody else is ready. And also, they're so focused on making sure they're all right. They're not thinking about, they're not coming from a place of empathy. Do you know what I mean? They're thinking about what's fair.
Mm. Shereen, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was Cafe Nero. So the CEO of Cafe Nero sent an email to all staff in the company saying, I want you to know that as a company, we want to support every single one of you. So if any of you experience any discrimination at any time, don't bother going to HR about it. You email me directly and I will sort it. What do you think of that?
What do I think? Well, that's one way of dealing with it. That's what I'm going to say, Harry. I can't. That's all I'm going to say. That is a possible way of dealing with it. That's all I'm going to say.
If there was one thing that you think companies could be doing in the next few weeks to actively support their black employees, what would you like to see them doing?
Do you know what? What I would like to see them doing is push past their discomfort and, you know, this whole thing about being worried about getting it right. Because now a lot of people are like, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to offend anybody. You know, push past that discomfort. Do a bit of work. You know, do a bit of reading. Go and, you know, listen, ignorance is 2020. It's not an excuse. Google is free, my friend. So go and type in all the terms that you want. Ask all the questions that you want. Read. There's lots of articles. There are lots of people speaking up about this. You know, if you must, go and binge watch a whole lot of my videos because I give you a next level of real talk about this. And question everything that you've done as a business before that's clearly not worked because, you know, we're feeling the way we're feeling and we are where we are.
Yeah.
And then at least when you do reach out and have those conversations with your black employees and have consistent and continuous conversations, don't just do it one time and then tick it off your list and go, that's done, on to the next thing, is just be prepared to listen, you know, and know that they might tell you things that's going to make you deeply uncomfortable. And also they might tell you things that you might have had a part and parcel in contributing to the way they feel. But you have to resist the urge to react. You know, and just listen and don't ask questions because you're trying to either get them to justify it because it's not clear in your mind, or don't ask them questions because you're fast forwarding and thinking, okay, as a business, we've got to do X, Y, and Z. Just be present. Let them voice their experiences. Let them know that it's safe. Let them know that they're not, there's no repercussions of them speaking out, because that is what's stopping a lot of people speaking out, Harry, a lot of people, because they're worried that when all this excitement dies down, they will be remembered as the one who, you know, spilled the beans about all sorts of practices that have been going on in the business.
Yeah. Shireen, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your brilliant take on it. It was great to hear from you. Shireen Daniels, Director of HR Rewired, there talking about how businesses can support their black employees during this time, but also beyond it, above and beyond, as she says, when all the excitement dies down, how can we make sure that we are still behaving in a manner that shows empathy and support, not just to the people that look like us, but to every single person in our employ.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
Over the past couple of years, Florence Given's Instagram account, challenging beauty standards and getting us all to see ourselves differently, has taken Instagram by storm, and it's resulted in her new book, Women Don't Owe You Pretty, all about seeing the world through a feminist lens and making it her mission to challenge oppressive attitudes towards women, our kind of girl. She joins us now. Hi, Florence.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us why that title, Why Women Don't Owe You Pretty?
So it's inspired by the quote by Erin McKean, and the quote begins saying, "You don't owe prettiness to anyone." And the quote ends, it's a very long quote, and the quote ends with saying, "Prettiness is not the rent you pay to exist in the world as a woman." And this kind of quote, it's quite a few years old. I saw it on some Tumblr blog, and it changed my life forever because it forced me to examine the kind of measures that women apply prettiness just to be treated better in society, and also how different women, depending on their intersections and their identities, depending on race, sexuality, whether they're able-bodied, whether they're queer, whether they're straight, all of these things contribute to how much you are expected to perform prettiness. And when I talk about performing prettiness, I mean anything from wearing makeup, doing your hair, wearing a certain type of clothing, shaving your body hair, all of these kinds of things that women do just to be treated with respect in the world.
You said it changed your life. In what way?
I think I looked at the stuff I was doing and I questioned whether I was doing it for me or whether I was doing it for the validation that I was desired, not just by men, but by society and people in general. And there's a quote in my book, and it says, I've used it in my on my Instagram as well, and it says, how much of my femininity is genuine and how much of it is a product of patriarchy. You know, I always question how much of my femininity is who I genuinely am and how much of it is a product of growing up in a society that does encourage women to perform a certain way to feel valid.
Why is it that in 2020, because I'm a bit old now, I'm nearly 40, and I've been looking at this stuff for a while, and I think I learned it in my 20s. I was like, this is not something I want to buy into. I've got to think about how I step outside of it. And I hoped that when I was doing that, my legacy would be the generation below me, or the women of your age, would be like, oh, look, we don't have to do it. And yet, here we are in 2020.
Absolutely.
No, women still believe in it. Why is that?
I mean, it's you know, the whole reason that we, let's take shaving body hair, for example, the whole reason that women shave our body hair is because of a capitalist seed of insecurity. You know, women didn't shave their body hair before the 1920s. Gillette wanted to make a load of money making razors and decided that they were going to put these ads out that encouraged women to shave their bodies. And of course, now we actually pay more for razors because they're pink, and anything pink has like a tax added onto it. So there's all of these kind of things. It's like, you know, we were never insecure about our body hair until we were told to be insecure about it to make money for people who own large corporations. And I think it's I can't tell you why it's still the way it is. But I think it's definitely time to start challenging these narratives. And women, like you said, women have been doing this for ages, but it's important that we keep this conversation going, because still it's clearly very pernicious and very insidious in the ways that it's so normalized, and we accept it as a given that we're supposed to do these rituals.
Well, so normalized, and in a way that we're rewarded for it, because, you know, one of the things I'm very aware of is, and I said, yeah, I've spent years trying to challenge this idea that as a woman you have to show up looking a certain way in order to be acceptable. And yet there are some times where I'm like, do you know what? It's just easier. It's just easier if today I blow dry my hair and I put on a load of makeup and I get my eyelashes done. People will be nicer to me. I'll get further. People will listen to me. I'm going to have I'll get a seat on the bus. It'll be an easier day.
Absolutely. It is a form of survival for a lot of women. You have two choices when you wake up in the morning and you go out into the world. You say, okay, do I show up as my authentic self? Do I show up in a way that I feel comfortable, you know, just going out wearing whatever, not doing whatever to my face or my hair? And, you know, the benefit of that is that you don't compromise yourself, but you'll probably be met with unsolicited remarks, not the treatment you want and deserve. And you'll feel that. So you have the benefit of being yourself, but also you know that you're not going to be treated as nicely. Or you say, well, instead, I could just use the tools around me and pay with prettiness to avoid those unsolicited remarks. You either way, it comes at a cost. So it's at the cost of your authentic self, or it's at the cost of, literally, the cost of buying things to make yourself look pretty, and the time and energy that goes into that.
Do you think it's easier if, and you know, I've seen your Instagram, I follow you, I think you're absolutely great, but you are a conventionally very attractive young woman.
Yeah.
Do you think it's easier if, you know, is it easier to stand there and say, oh, actually, you know, I'm not going to shave my legs, I'm not going to put on makeup, I'm not going to, if you still look pretty great anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this is where there's so much nuance in my book. I cover all of this. Me being able to grow out my body hair is, in fact, a privilege. Even though society at large is still repulsed by it, the fact that I can shave my body hair off and still be considered desirable by a large portion of people is very much a privilege. And although I do experience, when I don't perform prettiness and when I do go outside, not performing the extra layers of femininity, even just by virtue of me being white, people treat me better, and that contributes towards pretty privilege as well. And even though prettiness is subjective, we do need to acknowledge that society as a whole, our idea of pretty is informed by racial, fatphobic, transphobic, and racial bias.
How do you think social media plays into this? Because it's interesting to me that you have kind of come through on a platform which both on the one hand massively validates us for showing up and looking a certain way and behaving a certain way and putting a certain filter on it, and also at the same time seems to be the home of the kind of revolution against that.
Right. Yeah, I think it's acknowledging that in an ideal world, again, it's what I said, when you go out into the world, you make a choice. You say, OK, I can keep my feminist morals, or I can acknowledge the system that I'm in and conform to a certain degree to if that makes me able to get my message across. And the thing is with my work, it's very bright, it's very colourful, and it's very provocative. And my work has to be that way to capture people's attention and then to draw them into these very uncomfortable topics. And I think that's what I do with my social media. I didn't post a picture of myself for at least a year and a half when I started my Instagram account. It was just all of my illustrations. And then when I started to gain the confidence to articulate myself and talk more about these issues and more about my experiences, that's when it resonated with people a lot more, because all of a sudden there was a face to it and people were like listening and engaging with me. And I think there's, like you said at the beginning, it's like, how do we navigate these platforms? And I think it's about making it work for you. It's about having boundaries with these platforms. How much content do you consume? Who do you follow? Do they make you feel like crap about yourself, or do they make you question yourself in a healthy way? Do they challenge your perceptions and your ideas? And I think for women in particular, we are encouraged to put everybody first. And I think doing so, to have people on social media who are encouraging an alternative narrative, to just see that there is another way that you're able to thrive, I think that's great. And especially as social media now is basically the new media, full stop, for a lot of young people. I think it's important that people are using these platforms to infiltrate with all of these very incredible political ideas.
Florence, if a young woman is listening to this and thinking, well, I hear what you're saying and I buy into it and I feel that way too. I feel like I'm paying a price to show up and be accepted, and I'd much rather just be able to turn up as myself, but I don't know if I can. What advice would you give her?
I'd say that that's okay. Like, if you don't feel that you are able to show up as your authentic self, because you know that when you apply these, this is the thing, right? It's about choice, but it's about knowing about your choice. It's about the awareness behind your choices. So when you do these things, it's about being aware that you're doing it because you know that it's an easier route. And I think it's ridiculous that we judge women who pay for these procedures, sometimes, you know, aesthetic procedures, to fit into the mold when that we know that they're going to be treated better when they do so. So I absolutely do not judge women who quote unquote conform. It's a survival thing. And also, I think the roundabout answer to all of this is that it doesn't matter if it's in line with your desires. You know, every time I do something, I ask myself, is this in line with my desires? Or by doing this, am I going to be denying myself? And if it means that I'm denying myself, am I doing it for a reason, because it's for my safety? A lot of the things we do as women are harm reduction, right? When we leave the house, we do certain things with our appearance for harm reduction. We deny our reality, or we say certain things to people, or we lie to protect our safety. We deny our reality for harm reduction, and that's okay.
Florence, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us here on Badass Women's Hour. It's been great having you. That was Florence Given talking about her new book, Women Don't Owe You Pretty, Why We Don't Have to Slap on the Slap Just in Order to Be Accepted.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast. You can get in touch on all the socials on at Badass Women's Hour.
Now, this week saw the launch of a new book that has gone straight to the top of the bestsellers list, partly because of the relevance of what she has to say right now, but also because of the brilliance of the way she says it. So I'm very lucky to be joined by Candice Braithwaite, author of I Am Not Your Baby Mother. Hi, Candice.
Hi, Harriet. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm sure you're having a full-on week. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm going to give you a little bit of detail about you, and then you know, can definitely add to it. But you are part of, in a way, the Instagram mother generation, which is mothers basically highlighting their lives and talking about their lives on Instagram. And yet you have taken a really, I feel like, full-on approach to it, which is basically like, hang on, I've looked at this and it's filled with middle-class white women whose lives all look the same, behaving in the same way, saying the same things, doing the same things. Where are the black mothers on Instagram? I am going to stand up and bring them together and represent them and highlight other brilliant women doing the same. Is that a fair assessment?
Very fair, very fair. Yay. I'm almost borderline anti-establishment.
So take us back. When you first decided that this is what you were going to do, what provoked it in you? What was the moment where you said, actually, hang on, I think we need something different here?
At the time, this was almost 7 years ago, I was working for a publishing house. And this is when blogging was big. And I was spending my entire day reaching out to bloggers to see how much they were charged to promote a book. And the money they were telling me, I was like, oh, my gosh, this is an actual business. And I feel like there's a gap in the market I could be filling here, especially in the parenting space. And so, much to my other half's dismay, I quit my job and I just went all in on becoming obsessed with content creation and really pushing the black motherhood and nuclear family narrative. And almost a decade down the line, now we're here. So that was that.
Specifically for you, what have been some of the, I guess, some of the key highlights of doing this, and also some of the struggles or some of the misconceptions that you've really had to correct, or that you find social media throwing up again and again?
The key highlights is definitely being able to call myself a businesswoman and to be able to work from home and see my children and build a business and a brand that I'm proud of. Definitely one of the negatives is online trolling. I'm not new to that. That's really terrible and can have a detrimental effect on mental health. But then again, on the flip side, I've made some very firm and forever friends in this space also. And so, especially running the initiative Make Motherhood Diverse, I think I've really done well at bringing different types of women and people together. And so I just lean into the positive all the time.
One of the things that I personally learned from you was when you started talking about the fact that black women are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. Mm. And the experience of childbirth for black women and how different it is. And I know that for you particularly, it was quite traumatic.
Yeah, it was. Emergency C-section after 19 hours of induced labour, 3 days of telling various midwives I didn't feel well, fell asleep with my baby girl on my chest. She moves down and her baby weight makes a septic sac beneath my C-section wound explode. Thank God it exploded, but I was rushed back to hospital slipping into septic shock, and then I was in intensive care for 5 weeks. So really not the best start to motherhood at all. But back then, 7 years ago, I thought I was one of one because I didn't have many mummy friends. As the years have gone on, I'm speaking to more black mothers, and traumatic birth experiences are usually what happens. It's actually very rare, in my opinion, to listen to a black woman's birth story and for it to just be blissful, simple and straightforward. And so when the Embrace report came out in 2018, it was like finally having data to support what we already knew. Black women are not listened to in childbirth. They're not listened to in the healthcare system. People do not believe the amount of pain we're in. And this doesn't just go for childbirth, rates of black women being later to be diagnosed with cancer, the data surrounding BAME patients and COVID. Like, there is a pattern here. And so being able to campaign for this is something really close to my heart.
Your new book, I Am Not Your Baby Mother, what inspired you to write it, and what are some of the key things people can learn from it?
Nothing inspired me to write it. I didn't want to write it at all, to be honest, Harriet. There were six other proposals that had gone out before this book, and for various reasons, everyone turned me down. And then, you know, my management team were like, oh, everyone wants to hear about motherhood. And I was a bit offended by that, because what I could see from motherhood material at the time is it seemed to be very, how many gins can you drink before bath time? And I just thought, well, this isn't long-lasting material, is it? But I was so enraged. I wrote this proposal in 45 minutes, sent it to my management team and my husband, and said, I never want to speak to you guys again about it. Leave me alone. But then we had a book deal within a week. So now we're...
No, always the way.
but I will say it is definitely the book I had to write, and its purpose was just to offer up a different narrative, a bit like why I went online in the first place. Can you believe it's the first book backed by a major house in the UK about Black British motherhood in 2020? Yeah. That has absolutely blown my mind, and I just wanted the book to shed some light on the... not just the difficulties, but the nuance of being a Black British mother. I think, you know, from the review so far, I think I've done my job, to be fair.
What is it like being a Black British mother right now, in this moment in time?
Oh, it's a bit nerve-wracking, if I'm honest. Yeah. Especially being the mother to a Black son.
Yeah.
Having a son is the reason why I decided to move out of London. I keep a very close eye, almost a scientific eye, on knife crime rates. I'm watching it go up and up year upon year. And there are things like he's only two and he's very boisterous. And I already worry about him going to school and at 4 or 5 years old, him being written off as a nuisance just because he moves like he's got ants in his pants. So as a Black British mother right now, it's how it's always been. Your heart is always in your mouth. You're worried about them being judged. You're worried about the police being aggressive with stop and search. You're worried about knife crime and gang culture and people making, you know, having stereotypes about your children before they get to prove themselves. I would say that's been even heightened in the last few weeks due to the universal protests in response to George Floyd's murder. And so it's really up the ante on the feeling of fear that comes with Black British motherhood, for sure.
Do you think that the universal Black Lives Matter protests taking place at the moment, that the kind of feeling this is engendering throughout the world, do you think it's going to change things for Black children as they grow up into the next generation?
Not the next generation, no. Although I will say Gen Z are super duper activated, and they will, they're really willing to put up a fight. But it won't. It's not for my kids. It's not for my kids' kids. I think it's for my kids' kids' kids. So we're talking 3, 4 generations down the line. These things, you know, Michelle Obama said it on her tour. Progress isn't linear. There will be dips that remind us of how far we've come and how far we have to go. And right now, I think, you know, we're on a bit of an up, but there will be more dips along the way. And even the work I do think sometimes I put my head in my hands and I think, why are you doing this, Candice? This is very exhausting work. But I'm doing it perhaps for the grandkids I will never meet. A bit like how, in the, you know, when my dad was growing up, he said he always wanted to be a writer, but as a Black boy growing up in the 70s, he didn't see how he could do it. And now his daughter, even though he's not around as a Sunday Times bestseller, the needle always moves. And so the change won't be magnificent, but I think it will happen in due course.
It's really interesting. So we had Leila Saad on the show earlier, and she said, you know, part of her work is she does because she wants to be a good ancestor.
Yeah.
So she wants the generations that come after her to look back at her and say, yes, she did things which changed things for us.
Yes.
Do you feel some of that?
Yeah, definitely. Layla is literally my sister and label mate. And I tell her all the time, or we tell each other all the time, it's not for us. This work is not for us. And it is to be referenced. It is to say, oh, well, that Candice Brathwaite from 100 years ago helped move this story along. you know, and we women like myself and Layla, we are the product of the people who came before us and tried to push things forward. So you just have to stay committed, you know. I mean, even looking at the book charts this week, something's happening. Something, all of a sudden, this need, this rush to just drink in black voices. I hope it's not just a trend. I hope it continues for a while.
You talked about how social media can be a rough place, and it really can for everyone, but I think particularly we all know for black women. How do you look after yourself within that?
I am very, very strict about my boundaries, and I used to be, and I don't, this isn't just about race, this is about being a female. A profile would follow me and I'd feel a bit funny, but then my female mind would go, oh gosh, but they haven't insulted me yet. It will be really rude if I block them. And then 2 weeks down the line, so done, it will turn up that profile was a troll. So now, the minute a profile pops up and I don't even like the profile picture, you are out of here. My social media space is not a democracy. It's not where everyone gets to pile in and tell me what they want and I try and figure it out for them. And especially because black women are the most trolled and abused online, I am really, really strict about my boundaries. If I don't like something, I think my block list now is at about 7,000 people. My fingers hurt from blocking people. I set keywords. I've turned off the auto responses in my direct messages. There are just small things I do to manage my mental health. But even me, someone who has a big platform, I do believe these tips should be for every woman online. Because you shouldn't show up in your online space and think that you have to take abuse. You shouldn't.
One of the things I love about your online presence is that you really stand for... You're an activist who doesn't just want to talk about being an activist. I think today you said it's about being an activist and also the softness, being able to talk about the softness. So being able to talk about, I've just bought this really amazing dress, or I really love this lipstick shade, or being able to balance both of them and actually show all women as rounded people.
Yeah, my activism is always going to come with a side of couture, and I don't really care who that annoys, because these are the things that make me feel good, and I'm very deserving of feeling good and the nicer things in life. And again, I have to set an example, especially for black women who are always made to feel like they should shrink themselves and not ask for a lot. No, it's okay to say that the world is slightly unfair, but you still really like a designer dress. It is absolutely fine to say that. And I think, I think about the way my mum dressed when I was growing up and my nan dressed when, like, they didn't play small in that area. And so I like people to come to my social media and in between educated, just see that I'm trying to get as much joy out of life as possible. And so I hope that's how it comes across anyway.
Oh, it definitely does. Finally, what advice would you give to other black mothers around the UK at the moment who are maybe struggling with how they talk to their kids about what's going on, or as you say, worrying about kind of their welfare and how they're going to grow up in this world? What would you want them to know?
What would I want them to know? My kids are still fairly young, so I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I do think it is about making room for what white people would perhaps say are uncomfortable conversations, but in the black community are needed conversations. They're necessary conversations. I would say don't delay on that. Take a soft approach. Make sure your child can see themselves, be it in books or in certain shows you've chosen to watch, because you cannot be what you cannot see. And I would also say, black British mothers, to just take a load off yourself. It's a high pressurized environment, and what you're doing now is good enough. You know, as long as you love your child and you are honest about how the reality is that them being black is going to mean their life is a bit more of a struggle, then you're doing the best you can.
You are definitely doing the best you can, and thank you for sharing it with us, both online and in your book. Candice, it's always a joy to talk to you. You are just wisdom personified, so thank you very much for sharing it. Candice Brathwaite there, author of I Am Not Your Baby Mother, which is out now. If you're one of the few people that hasn't bought a copy, go get it. It's great. Candice just can hear, it's so funny and rich and warm. Just a lot of learning in her book.
You've been listening to Badass Women's Hour. If you like the show, then help more people find us. You can tag us or talk to us on social media using @BadassWomen'sHour. Or you can be really lovely and leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us up the podcast rankings and allows other people to find us. We'll be back next week with more badass guests and in-depth chat.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.